Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks a lot for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. We will spend most of our show this time around on the budget agreement that members of Congress at long last just agreed on and its implications for DOD and for military personnel. There are several aspects of the agreement that have an impact on the Pentagon. The most welcome from the perspective of its leaders is the easing of sequestration for the next 2 years. This year, the caps imposed by the 2011 Budget Control Act will go up from $498 billion to $521 billion. The relief is a bit less pronounced in 2015, but nonetheless, DOD leaders say they at least now have a gradual ramp to downsize their operations to the funding level sequestration requires, rather than having to slice indiscriminately and all at once. Also important to the military community, some cutbacks to pay and benefits. Civilian workers across the government will take what's essentially a pay cut. They'll be required to pay 1.3% more from their annual pay toward their pensions, although their pensions will not change. And military retirees will get smaller cost of living adjustments to their pensions while they're still at working age. We'll get more in depth on that change later in our show. We start, though, with Russell Rumbaugh. He leads the budgeting for foreign affairs and defense program at the Stimson Center. In the Washington think tank world, he was just about the first off the line to publish some analysis on what the budget deal means for defense.
There's two big things it does to DOD's budget picture, or national defense in general. It significantly relieves the cliff still to come in FY14. Instead of letting the lowest point of sequester fall in FY14, that now won't occur until FY16. That means 4 years of what will seem like flat budgets. It means both more time to plan, more time to get used to and prepare for these lower levels, and at the same time still does achieve the same level of cuts eventually. The second big thing it does is not in the DOD part, but rather in the offsets the budget deal provides. The two particular ones stand out. It reforms both civil service and military pensions. By doing so, it theoretically can provide greater resources for the other parts of DOD, the discretionary parts, the parts like buying weapons, training troops, and those kind of things that are absolutely important to keep the Department of Defense focused on its main job.
The leadership of the department has been saying that in 13, the first year of sequestration, they were able to avoid doing what would have been some of the dumbest management decisions by, you know, using prior year unobligated funds, draining management reserves, but that in 14, they would not have any of those tools. Those tools would have already all been expended. Does this deal mitigate all the things that they were worried about in 14, not having that flexibility?
Provided they make actual decisions on what the future is going to look like. 14 is still going to be $30 billion lower than what the president initially requested in April. That's a pretty big drop from what the original program was. If they don't make choices within that, it's a big hole to fill with those temporary measures like you listed off. But they've already had 1 year of getting down there. They've been making the plan since spring to prepare the department for these lower levels. So now you can make choices and make decisions that actually have a healthy department, even though it's at a lower level.
Right. And they've been saying that they've been obligating in 14, basically at 13 sequester levels. So if that's true, they'll probably be on the right trajectory, right?
Absolutely. And maybe even more importantly, in their plan for the FY15 budget, so this is the next year's, this is the one that the president is going to announce in February, they've always had this rider going along of, while you're building next year's budget, think about how you would execute it in 14. So although we're already in 14, they're also doing advanced planning for 14. Hopefully what that means is that now that they've got these caps, or now that they know what their actual amount is, they know what choices to make to prepare the department for the future.
When you look at things like the civilian workforce, obviously they had to do furloughs last year to stay within the BCA caps, but they still have that same number of employees working, or something similar to that same number of employees. How do they get through 14 without doing something like that again? Do you have any guesses?
Each year that passes makes it a little bit easier. And hopefully enough has happened that they don't have to take those really extreme examples like furloughing those who are already at work. So because there's been a hiring freeze, because pay has been frozen, and now because there's a plan to the future, right, because it doesn't have to all happen at 14 but can be spread out for a few years, hopefully you can take advantage of attrition, people who are going to retire anyway, people who are already going to move out, to start recalibrating the workforce so that they're all ready for the future and doing a job that the department thinks is necessary for the future. So hopefully no individual has to suffer the same pain that many across the department did last year, both under the sequester furloughs and the government shutdown.
On the adjustments to the military retiree pensions that you alluded to before, the military associations are up in arms about that, and it's their job to be upset about that kind of thing. But one of their complaints that seems valid to me is that it basically short-circuited the Military Compensation Commission that's examining all these issues in depth and is going to hopefully deliver recommendations on making that whole system more sustainable. I mean, do they have a point? Could that commission come back and deliver a package that maybe they're not even so upset about and actually saves even more money out of the military personnel accounts?
Sure. It's not clear to me those are exclusive outcomes. This was one step. In some ways, it's a minor step. It's a step many have called for before. It showed up in the fiscal commission already. And it's long been noted that military retirees are kind of in a unique position because they start drawing a pension so early in their career, or obviously definitionally at the end of their military career, but early in their working life, and many go on to start a second career. This does, the military associations are absolutely right, we are now providing less for our military retirees, but it's a gradual phase in, and hopefully it's something, especially with somebody having a second career, they can adjust to individually. When we get to the Military Compensation and Retirement Modernization Commission, hopefully they do come in with a much more robust package, something that looks at both the pluses and minuses that makes the entire compensation system more modernized. Likely it's still going to include acknowledging that all Americans are working later, and when somebody starts a second career in their 40s, they still have a very rewarding second career there to second career to take.
When you look at this whole area of military compensation, do you see any other big pieces of low-hanging fruit that could be enacted that's also politically possible?
Well, I don't think there's anything in this space that's low-hanging fruit. This requires real hard decisions that does affect the literally the livelihood of our military members and has repercussions all through the system. What are the recruiting? What are the retention incentives? So low-hanging fruit is probably something that never exists because individual people are going to be affected by this. There have been other suggestions, specifically the cost-sharing on things like healthcare that the department has been putting forward. Maybe those are picked up, but for the most part, I think we're probably waiting until the Compensation Commission to find out really big moving pieces.
Right. This deal, of course, is embodied just in a budget resolution, assuming it passes, but we also need appropriations bills still, too, right? Do you see that proceeding relatively smoothly along the contours of the budget agreement that we're talking about now, or does that process get potentially more contentious?
I don't think it gets more contentious. The appropriations process is well designed to make changes such as this. One of the great fallacies is that Congress only pluses things up. That's not true. Congress regularly pluses up or decreases, and they have a significant impact all the way across the program. They're well designed to, the process is well designed to make individual choices. What it doesn't do very well is serve as the basis for long-term deals, and we've seen that in the last few years. It's never been the appropriations bill that determined the final level of spending. Most notably, last year, when we had sequester punted from January to March, and there was a murmur that, oh, the appropriations bill will solve this. Well, that wasn't true at all. The appropriations bill was a stock appropriations bill, and just let sequester happen. Now that the budget agreement has finalized what those top-line caps are, especially for defense, it'll make the process much easier.
assuming that this deal stays in place and the top lines that we're projecting kind of stay where we think they're going to be, you alluded to this a little bit in our first in the first part of our conversation, but how does that line look in comparison with past defense drawdowns?
It looks much higher. It looks like a much higher level of resources than we've previously put to defense during the build downs. So the defense budget over time goes up and it comes down. It's fairly stable and looks fairly flat when you look at it across time, except it's got these peaks and valleys. In this case, we're headed down into a valley, but the valley is now going to be composed of two plateaus. The first one is the flat budgets from FY10 through FY12, and now another plateau, FY13 to FY16, where the budget is basically flat. There's a pretty big drop between 12 and 13, but it means there's a much more steady planning level there. And as you just suggested, where they're ending up is still at roughly $500 billion in today's dollars. In the past, the defense budget would draw down to something like $400 billion in today's budget. So wildly, we're going to have 25% more resources dedicated to defense, something that's been lost a little bit in all of the concerns about a declining defense budget.
Well, given that, I mean, it seems like there's at least a possibility that a few years down the road, people are going to start noticing that and pointing to those numbers and call for even further defense drawdowns. We can't rule that out, can we?
We certainly can't rule that out, and that's traditionally how defense budgets have been drawn down, other than one or two big particular moves. In the post-Cold War, the peace dividend really came in one big year drop and then was mild years. And so traditionally what's been done is mild cuts that, with the effects of inflation, add up to a slope. But we're still $100 billion down. So even if both the executive and legislative branch undercut each year's number a little bit, they're not likely to do it at the scale of 5% every year, year on year, which is what would take to get down to previous build-down levels. So although certainly defense may decline some more, and we can't rule out the possibility that there will be another major deficit reduction package, although nobody can see that on the horizon, it looks like defense is going to stay much higher than it has in the past.
All right, Russell, I guess finally, as you look out into the short term here, what are the key things to be watching as this budget process plays out on Capitol Hill and the management of it inside DOD?
There's some great things we should be watching for. First of all, the department has been doing significant planning for the 6 months. Do we see that reflected in the FY14 bills? Do they already know where the choices are to be made and go over and help the appropriators figure that out so we have a smooth transition from 14 to 15? On a substantive level, maybe the most interesting dynamic going on is the budget levels are only at what's called 050, the budget, national defense budget level. That includes not just DOD, but most particularly includes the nuclear weapons programs in the Department of Energy. Those nuclear weapons programs have been growing dramatically and have become really disconnected from their plans and the funding levels put to them. With this easing, are they going to go make those nuclear programs whole? Or are they going to go back through and take the conventional forces within DOD and make them healthy? So those are the two big things I think we should be watching for.
That's Russell Rumbaugh. He heads up the Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense Program at the Stimson Center. We alluded during our conversation to the extreme dissatisfaction among groups that represent military members and retirees about the cuts to future military pensions as a result of this budget deal. We'll talk to one of those groups when we come back from our first break. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serdin. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. Glad you're with us. Continuing our coverage of the new budget deal, what it means for defense and what it means for military members. We heard from our last guest that the changes to military personnel spending in the Ryan-Murray budget agreement was a modest step toward reining in the growth in that particular area of the military budget. Advocacy groups, though, who represent military retirees don't quite see things that way. Our next guest is Mike Barron, a recently retired Army colonel who now works as a lobbyist for the Military Officers Association of America. Mike, thanks for joining us. And we should probably, for folks who are not familiar with the military retiree system, just do a quick primer on how it works. So basically, if you you retire at 20 years in, you get basically 50% of your high three, right? And then an annual COLA every year. Why don't you take it from there and do a quick explainer on the status quo anyway?
Right. Basically, that's correct. I mean, it's going to be a little less than 50% because some of the additional amounts that are in that in your retirement pay or in your current pay are not going to be in there. Like service members, if they're serving in an area, there's going to be a housing allowance to help them cover the cost of housing. For example, if we have a service member assigned and his family assigned into the Washington D.C. area, we all know what the cost of living is around here. There's a little bit of there to help him out with that provision, and there's some other items in there. So it's going to be slightly less than 50%. But I mean, for a ballpark figure, it's roughly going to be, a half, 50% to minus of what their active duty pay is, again, taking away those additional pays at the 20 year point. And so no one qualifies for retirement in the military until they've done that service. And again, that's a very arduous, sacrificing career of 20 years, and at 20 years they can retire. We have a number of service members that going through their career, and we don't have a great amount that reach the 20-year retirement, but those that do, for example, if you take a sergeant first class, an enlisted member who's done 20 years of honorable service, by the time under this provision under the Ryan Murray budget agreement that basically reduces through a redux-like provision in their retirement, it reduces their overall retirement pay by about 20% by the time they reach age 62. So using that example of that sergeant first class, they're going to be losing about $3,700 per year by the time he or she reaches the age of 62. So real concern on that part of it. But, that's basically kind of puts in there right up front what our concerns are and how that affects the military retirement. Military service members do not pay into their retirement in terms of money every month. They pay into that in terms of service over that 20-year period. So, again, nobody qualifies for retirement unless they reach that 20-year period. And, again, very, very competitive career progression field, as well as all the requirements and commitments that are put on that service member and their family, whether it's separations or deployments to combat areas, those type of things. So very, very different type of a lifestyle than compared to most, if you will, civilian counterparts out there. But very different part of that on that. And so we see – so military retirement is really deferred earned compensation is what it is. And so they once they reach that 20-year mark, then they're able to they can retire and are able to draw on that pension. And these pensions are not huge by any means or any stretch of the mind. They're not very large. So that's a significant impact, again, using that example that I gave you right up front there with that losing $3,700 for that retiring sergeant first class per year by the time they reach age 62.
And just to explain the mechanics of the Ryan Murray changes here, so basically the status quo is that your cost of living adjustment is based on the consumer price index. It's tied directly to the CPI every year.
Yes.
The Ryan Murray change would make it CPI minus one percentage point. So, for example, I think it was something like 2.5% in 2012. The military, under this provision, the military retirees would get 1.5% COLA adjustment. I've generally learned over the years that it's a bad idea to try to do math on the radio, but that 20% estimate that you guys are using, I think, requires a little bit of explanation. How do you arrive at that estimate that a military member, a military retiree, would lose 20% of what had been there?
Yeah, because it compounds over time, and so what you're looking at, and again, I'll go back to my Sergeant First Class example. There is that, you know, if you're looking at based on a 3% COLA, which is basically what you would normally be. So if they retire with their income, which is going to be less than $24,000 a year. That's what their pension would be after 20 years of service. And you take a 1% on that, you're looking at a basic, you know, the first year is going to be, you know, $230. But again, that starts compounding. And so every year it grows. It's going to be 1.9% the second year and so forth. And so by the time you get to every year, it's going to add more on to it by the compounding piece of it there. And it's going to, so over time, that's where we come up with that number that's going to be roughly around $3,700. That average that they're going to lose every year based on those reduced COLAs is going to be about $3,700 per year. And our real concern here, too, is that there was a any previous times to look at any kind of reductions in the military retirement system, we're going to be basically grandfathering the currently serving force as well as the current retirees. And the Congress in last year's NDAA in 2013 established the Military Compensation and Retirement Modernization Commission, and they included clearly a grandfather clause there, and they also wanted to make sure that they wanted to make sure there was not going to be any kind of fast tracking, which this budget agreement does, is it clearly doesn't end run around any of the committees of oversight and expertise in the Senate, both the SASC, the Senate Armed Services Committee, and the House Armed Services Committee, go into those experts to look at what the impact is going to be on overall retention of our career force. And that's really what, when you have the military retirement system is clearly targeted towards the retention of the best quality career force we could have in both the officer and enlisted NCO Corps out there. We want to protect that because we want to retain those folks. And the last time Congress made a really bad decision and changed the retirement system from what it is currently, they went to a system called Redux, and it was a tremendous hit on overall career retention. And so it took all the Joint Chiefs going up in the spring of 2000 to say to Congress as a whole, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to say, you need to repeal this Redux retirement system because it's killing us as far as retention-wise. And that's when Congress changed back to the high three provision for their retirement. And what that is it takes the final 3 years of your active duty service and compiles that, and then the highest of those ends up being that number that you go with against, which you said we talked about at the beginning of roughly 50%, but it's actually less than that based on those other items being removed as well.
There's another provision in there, and this gets a little bit confusing, but once you hit 62 years of age, you're basically more or less made whole. So your annuity is calculated as though you had been getting COLAs that were tied to CPI for that entire period before age 62. And the argument for that, I think, is that's the point at which you are actually going to retire. You're no longer working a post-military job. That's when you actually need a retirement check the most. I'd like you to respond to that, if you could.
Yeah, well, I think what they're saying that makes it look like it's a nice provision there is that at age 62, there's a recalculation that basically puts you back onto the track of normal of COLAs, which is what you had fully expected earlier on. So again, this provision changes the game rules while you're in the middle of the game, because again, it does correct, definitely affects the career serving force as well as retirees. But the money that you've lost during that time period in your retirement, and I'll go back to my example again of that Sergeant First Class E7 retiring at 20 years, along with the average of losing $3,700 per month, per year under this provision, overall, they will have lost in that time period from the time that they retired at age 40 up until age 62, they'll have lost almost $83,000 that they will never, ever be able to recoup. So that's a significant hit on them. And again, I mean, why are we penalizing the, they've honorably served and they've served and they're able to retire, and then when they move on into a second career, most folks are not moving on into very high paying, very lucrative second careers. They're moving on to basically make up the money they would have lost over time that they didn't have in, say, putting an equity in a home, because military service members are required to move multiple times. Just using my example, I mean, my family and I moved, almost 20 times in a 30-year career. I mean, and many of these folks are moving many times, a lot of separations from their family, so they're not able to settle in roots and put equity into homes and those type of things. They've moved their kids at multiple schools multiple times throughout really tough times within their career period. So we're penalizing and trying to pay for this budget agreement, if you will, on the backs of folks who have honorably served their nation here, and you really see what the impact is financially overall, what that is. So it's being portrayed up front in the budget agreement as being not that big of an impact, but it clearly is, and that's why I keep going back to this example here of monetary terms how that's going to impact a military service member who retires after 20 years of honorable service.
Mike Barron is a retired Army colonel and the Deputy Director of Government Relations for the Military Officers Association of America. We'll continue our conversation about the effects the new budget agreement on Capitol Hill will have on military retirees after another quick break. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. We're talking on this week's show about the new budget deal in Congress, its effects on DOD, and in this part of the show, its impacts on military retirees. That was one of the key changes embodied in the deal. Those military pensions will get just a bit less generous for folks who are still of working age. Before the deal, pensions got a cost of living adjustment that was equal to the consumer price index every year. After the deal, that COLA every year will be the CPI minus 1 percentage point. That's until a retiree reaches age 62, and then everything resets once again. After that, the annual COLA gets recalculated as though nothing had ever happened. Our guest in this segment is Mike Barron, a retired Army colonel and the Deputy Director of Government Relations for the Military Officers Association of America. He says military members who are about to retire are getting blindsided by the deal, and that by the time they hit their 61st birthday, their pensions could be 20% smaller than they'd previously planned on. You know, we've all seen the analyses that project that personnel costs in DOD are going to consume the entire military budget by about a decade from now. MOA doesn't like this particular change, got it, but personnel spending is going to have to take a haircut in some way, shape, or form, isn't it?
Well, here's the truth of that, and there was a great story that was out this week before last in Military Times, where, and we've been doing this a long time as well as our military coalition partners here, is that we've been using when we push back on this, the personnel costs as a percentage of the DOD budget, the military personnel costs have averaged 30% since about 1980, and that's per DOD and Office of Management and Budget White House documents that clearly show that. When you try to throw in, and lately some folks have been doing that, they've been throwing in also the civilian personnel cost and a lot of in-kind costs as well, in saying that it jumps up this great number. That only pushes it up to about 40%, and it's going down. Now, so it's not true that these costs have been exploding over time, and it's also over time, and the number that's always keeps using is they go back to a date of 2001, like the world didn't exist before 2001. We all understand 9/11, but the defense budget has also gone up extremely high over that time period as well. So there was some costs that went on with that, and so during that time period, there was some payments that were made, to support the personnel costs. It was also some payments that were made to catch up on personnel pay, which was not compatible to civilian pay. Military pay by the end of the 90s was at 13.5% below comparable cost or pay to the civilian sector. And so Congress indexed our military retirement pay to ECI, Employment Cost Index, to try to catch that up. So that was included in there as well over that time period. But the costs are clearly not exploding out. And so those are some really gross overstatements that are being made by senior leadership out of the Pentagon and such. And none of their documents that we've looked at, or, and again, I go back to this recent story that was put out in Military Times week before last that goes back and takes each one of those arguments there and then goes against what is clearly portrayed and laid out in DOD and OMB budget documents to counter all those arguments and clearly show that personnel costs have remained pretty stable over the last 30 years at around 30%, and that's the military personnel.
Well, and we should point out, though, that those projections I referenced aren't just out of OSD. They're similar numbers coming out of, outside think tanks, pretty much every group that's looked at this. There was this big conflagration of think tanks from left, right, and center a few months ago that all got together and said, look, military personnel costs is one of these growth areas that DOD's really got to tackle. I mean, let me just take one more run at that, Mike. I mean, is there some way in which this MILPERS account needs to have its growth rate adjusted?
Well, I think everybody understands that DOD is going to have to look at overall cost. I mean, let's look, for example, at the acquisition cost. I mean, acquisition over the last couple of years has been $411 billion over cost in cost overruns. I mean, so when you take a look at that, if you just put that money against it, that almost pays for 8 years of what is proposed under sequestration to cover that. And so what's being looked at on that part of it, we hear all this stuff being thrown around about personnel costs, which, again, we absolutely don't agree with, and the documents that we're looking at don't agree with. And I think overall, that's why Congress has not made any major changes, because when it gets up there and the professional staff look at those documents as well, or what's being proposed,
They're saying kind of, you know, where, show me where this is really happening. And they're not able to do that because it's not true. You know, costs have remained pretty stable over time at 30% overall. But we ought to really be looking at acquisition reform here and try to fix these programs that are in grossly cost overruns before we start trying to balance the budget on the backs of those who have honorably served their country.
I understand one of the objections is that this agreement kind of does an end run around the Military Compensation Commission that you mentioned that's doing a comprehensive look at this.
Right.
What are your hopes for the outcome of their work, and do you see them, you know, undoing this, making recommendations that would undo this anyway, and finding another approach to finding personnel savings or modifying the system?
I think we would hope that they would look at this in a very comprehensive way. I mean, we've provided testimony before the commission. We clearly understand why the Congress authorized this commission, but they clearly also put in their authorization that this would not be a fast track. They didn't want to do that. Didn't want to go to a BRAC-like thing process here because they wanted to allow people to take a comprehensive look at every one of the recommendations that does come out of this commission and look at it. And really they need to look at it, and they wanted to look at it in terms of how this would impact retention and readiness of the force. And that's critical when you look at anything having to do with personnel compensation and in particularly in retirement piece of it. So we would hope that they would look at this if this agreement does go through. I know it's already passed in the House, but we will see what happens in the Senate. But if it does go through and it does take action on this thing, we would hope that the commission would look at this and see that this is not a fair way of doing this. This is not a good way of doing this, and this really could and will impact on which is our major concern here on the overall retention and readiness of the force. And I hope they would look at that.
Yeah, you mentioned retention. A lot of times, retention and recruiting get bundled together as though they're one concept. But is it really right to think about retention being the major problem here? Because I'm not sure a 17-year-old who's thinking about going into a military academy spends a lot of time thinking about CPI and COLA in their retirement.
No, Jared, I think you're exactly right. No, I mean, retention is a very different thing. Retention, and that's most young, you know, troops coming in. I mean, that's not an overall top of their concern. I mean, I don't think when I came in the, studying to become, you know, an officer and stuff as a cadet, I was thinking about my retirement. I don't think I was doing that. I don't think most folks are doing that at that age. There's different pieces of it there that draws them into the service along with, you know, service to the nation. There's also some different compensation pieces that are there. But as far as retirement is really focused on the retention of retaining the best quality career force that we can for both officers and enlisted folks, the non-commissioned officer corps. That's really the backbone of the uniformed services, and every one of the services, that's their backbone there. And we're trying to, and so that retirement is targeted at career retention of those folks. And that's what we talk about in terms of retention and readiness. So recruitment, you're absolutely right, is a different focus here. The retirement piece of it here and how this affects that is going to hit the currently serving force, particularly if you're looking at soldiers out there that are at that mid-career point, you know, or an officer that's about 9 or 10 years into the service, they're making that decision whether they should stay or not. And they're going to look at what's the retirement mean for me? Is it going to be worth, you know, the things that I'm doing now or that I've had to do with my family, moving them or being separated, going to Iraq or Afghanistan for multiple tours? Is this going to be worth it to me at the end of 20 years to stay, or should I go ahead and leave now and go on and seek employment or other employment in the private sector? And that's really what comes down to. If it's not worthwhile, then those folks are not going to stay. And that's what the problem was when they had this last major bad decision on retirement, the Redux system, is that you had a lot of those folks voting with their feet. They were leaving the service, saying it's not worth it for me to stay the 20 years. I'm going to go ahead and leave and go seek employment elsewhere. In the private sector, and that's why the Joint Chiefs all went to the Hill and said, look, you got to repeal this thing. It's killing us as far as retention of the career force, both in our officers and non-commissioned officers.
That's Mike Barron, a retired Army colonel and the Deputy Director of Government Relations for the Military Officers Association of America. Even as that provision makes its way into law, there already is some talk in the Senate about repealing it and replacing it with some alternative cost-saving measures to the federal budget. We'll hear about those when we come back from our final break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Servin. And we are back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. Wrapping up our show this week with a little bit more on the provision of the new Ryan Murray budget agreement affecting military retirees. Just to recap that provision quickly, it helps to offset sequestration for the next 2 years, saving about $6 billion by cutting back on the annual cost of living increases retirees get from their pensions. Right now, they're adjusted every year to match inflation exactly, according to the Consumer Price Index. Under the changes, it would be inflation minus 1 percentage point. That is, until a retiree is 62 years old, then everything goes back to normal. Military associations, as we heard in our last interview, think that's unfair because it changes the deal for people who are currently serving or who are already retired. Some senators agree with that sentiment. Senator Carl Levin, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, says he supports the overall budget package, but since the provision on retirees doesn't take effect until 2015, he plans to spend the next year holding hearings on the issue and looking for alternatives. Meanwhile, the two senators from Virginia have already proposed an alternative. Democrats Tim Kaine and Mark Warner have introduced legislation that would repeal those pension cuts and replace that $6 billion with a tax code provision that purports to stop U.S. companies from evading taxes by moving their assets overseas. Here is Senator Warner speaking just before the budget vote.
While I am voting for the overall budget, I'm actually going to be later today introducing legislation along with Senator Shaheen and maybe a few other senators that would actually take this piece of the budget compromise out and replace it with another pay for. Now, the chances of whether that legislation gets through, we'll wait till next year. It won't hold up the budget. But I absolutely believe that, particularly on one of these small deals, that we shouldn't have singled out our military retirees to take an unfair hit. I've told our military families all along that when we get to a big deal, whether it's TRICARE, whether it's these military pay and retirement, just as when we look at Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid, all of these programs are going to have to share a little bit of pain if we're going to get our fiscal house back in order. And that's why I actually hoped this budget compromise would have been a bigger deal, would have been broader than 2 years, would have actually dealt with entitlement reform, dealt with revenues through reform of the tax code. But when entitlements and tax code changes were taken off the table, it narrowed the scope, and whether you're new federal employees making higher contributions or these military veterans getting a slightly smaller COLA increase, now it's still going to be an increase, but it will be slightly smaller, they feel singled out. So to my mind, this argues all the more for why we need that grander bargain where there's a little bit of shared sacrifice across the board. So to rectify that, I'm putting forward this legislation with Senator Shaheen. We'll have to see if it gets any traction. But I would like to avoid this being part of the deal.
And again, that's Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner talking about new legislation he's just introduced that would replace the cuts in military pension COLA adjustments in the new Ryan Murray budget agreement with new legislation that would replace that $6 billion with a tax change that would stop U.S. companies from evading taxes by moving their assets to offshore tax havens. We've been spending most of our hour talking about the Ryan Murray budget agreement. If you missed any of our show, including our talk with Russell Rumbaugh from the Stimson Center about the overall contours of the deal and its impact on DoD's budget, or our more in-depth conversation about the cuts to military retiree pensions, we will post this entire show, as always, on our website, federalnewsradio.com/ondod. That's going to do it for this week's program. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.